In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Why was it believed that a transfusion of lamb's blood could cure epilepsy? What kind of surgery could you get in ancient Egypt? And were medieval surgical practitioners really a help to patients or a hindrance? On today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, Paul Craddock speaks to Emily Briffitt to unravel the long history of surgery, from its ancient roots right up to transformative recent developments, including antiseptics, antibiotics, and simple lessons learned from farmers and embroiderers. Tackling listener questions and top search queries, Paul shows how procedures that we might not bat an eyelid at today revolutionised past societies.
Hi, Paul. It's lovely to be talking to you today.
Thanks so much, Emily. It's lovely to be here. It's lovely to be invited.
So we're going to be talking about everything all our listeners wanted to know about the history of surgery. But just to start us off, could you tell us a little bit about you, your research? Have you got any cool projects going on at the moment?
Yes, I am a cultural historian of medicine. I've written a book about the history of transplant surgery from the 16th century to the present day. And as for cool projects, when I was pulling together some of the themes in that book, I was invited to watch a kidney transplant. And it was incredibly boring. I don't understand surgery. As a surgeon, I'm a historian. But later it occurred to me, actually, I was seeing a musical structure emerging. So I'm actually working with an ensemble called Riot Ensemble to produce a musical response to kidney transplant. And its first performance was 2 weeks ago. But there should be more coming up. So keep your eyes and ears peeled.
So now we're going to dive into this history of surgery. But I think the most important, and it's one of our top searches, is what has the word surgeon meant historically? How has the role of that changed?
Well, a surgeon is basically someone who cures bodily diseases using their hands. It literally means hand working, or someone who works with their hands. And on one level, that hasn't really changed. On one level, surgeons still cure their patients manually, but what it means to cure someone by hand has changed enormously because of technology. That's advanced, and attitudes have changed as well. So for the patient, it's obviously much less risky now to undergo most kinds of surgery, although it's quite fair to say most people don't enjoy surgery. It's quite another thing now that we have anaesthesia. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a surgeon in the 18th century called John Hunter, because he was the man that historians tend to cite when they talk about taking surgery from a craft to a science if I was going to choose one moment of development, that would be it, this sort of evolution. And I don't quite like that distinction technically, because I think science and scientific practices can be crafts, actually. But anyway, John Hunter, he was the first surgeon to really trust his senses. Actually, that's technically not true, but he's the most high-profile surgeon from that era. And there's a letter that I wanted to bring up that was written by the philosopher David Hume. Now, David Hume, he was an empiricist. He was known for sort of, you know, championing the value of information you got through sensing things. And he one day found a lump in his abdomen, and this was in 1776. And he consulted the best physicians that money could buy, or his money could buy. And all these eminent doctors examined him. And what they did is they did what doctors used to do. And that is, they used to take his history. They'd ask him various questions. They'd even consult the stars. And then they'd work out his treatments according to what they'd learnt at medical school. But none of them even touched him. And that's because, you know, doctoring back then, it involved book learning and it involved following the authority of his ancient Greek predecessors. And then when Hume consulted Hunter, who was at this point, 1776, he was at this point becoming quite a famous surgeon and anatomist. And he did something different. He actually put his hand on Hume's abdomen and he felt a tumour. He didn't need those sort of ancient text to tell him that it was a tumour. And it seems very strange to us today that that's not the first thing a surgeon would do. But you know, most doctors wouldn't have touched the patient, and most doctors didn't touch Hume.
So linking to this, Erin Yazdani on Facebook has asked, why have surgeons been seen as separate professions to doctors? Where did this difference stem from?
Well, from the Middle Ages, you know, medical practitioners, they organised themselves in a kind of a pyramid. So you had physicians at the top. They took the highest degrees. They knew the medical texts. They were familiar with the medical system as it had been set out by the ancients. So particularly Galen from the 2nd century, but also Hippocrates from the 5th and Aristotle as well. So traditional systems of medicine were a mishmash of various ancient writings. They'd been translated from Greek into Arabic sometime in the 800s, and from Arabic into Latin, after being actually worked on and interpreted in the Arabic language, then into Latin from the 1140s about then. And using this elaborate and really quite confusing and sometimes contradictory system of knowledge, a physician could help you with your lifestyle, you know, your diet and your exercise, and they could recommend courses of treatment to be given by people who were, well, lower in the hierarchy. So lower in that hierarchy, below doctors, below physicians, you had surgeons. And as we've already said a moment ago, they healed with their hands. And in fact, from about the 13th century, surgeons weren't just surgeons, they were barber surgeons and performed all kinds of hands-on treatments. And they were coalesced into their own company of barber surgeons from about 15... Well, I think it was actually in 1540 that was the company was constituted. So the medical systems that were the province of physicians, they prescribed treatments like bleeding for most ailments, actually. So you might have heard of the concept of the four humours. Basically, they were black bile, yellow bile, phlegm and blood. And they weren't ordinarily seen, but more like... Sometimes you could see them if you were ill, but they were more like concepts. And doctors thought that if you were in a state of health, they would all be balanced. If you were in a state of disease, they would be imbalanced. And bleeding was one of the ways to balance those humours. And in fact, that's where the barber pole comes from. The pole with the red and white stripes that symbolises the blood, and bandages wrapped around a pole that the patient would cling to. when they were bled. So much of the surgeon's time would be taken up with bleeding, but they could also do things like pull teeth, give enemas, apply ointments, drain sores, remove tumours, and amputate as well. And they could do your hair because they were barbers. But surgeons, they successfully fought, I should say, they fought to be split from barbers in 1745. That was when an act of parliament split them into two separate companies, the barbers and the surgeons. And the surgeons set up a new hall and anatomy theatre at Newgate Prison so they could dissect the executed criminals. So, yeah, the apothecaries, they were on the similar level to surgeons, and below them were sort of healers and quacks and things. So that's the pyramid. It's a long way to describe the pyramid. But I should say that doctoring and surgery are very closely linked. The 13th century surgeon, French surgeon, whose name I'm going to butcher because I'm terrible with the French language, but the 13th century French surgeon Henri de Mondeville, he said that it's impossible to be a good surgeon without having a foundation of medicine, and it's impossible to be a good physician without knowing something about surgery. But still, they tended to, you know, be educated separately and also be considered separate professions socially and culturally. You know, the medical faculty at Paris actually forbade medical graduates from performing surgery in the 14th century, I think that was. But then you also have at the other end of the spectrum, Bologna University, and they insisted that surgeons had medical training. So, yeah, they're very closely linked as professions, but they were separate in some very, very important ways.
All right. I would like to do a bit of a run through history of surgery. Mm. So if we start right at the very beginning, we've got a question from Marina CRS 2018 on Instagram. And she's asked, what is the earliest recorded surgical procedure?
Okay, right. The earliest recorded surgical procedures were, they were in the ancient Egyptian Abus papyrus, which actually that's not what the Egyptians would have called it. We call it that because a German Egyptologist called Georg Abus bought it on a trip to Egypt. I don't know what we should be calling it. We probably should not be calling it after the man who just bought it. But anyway, this papyrus, it contains the earliest written descriptions of surgery, like early tooth care, bone setting, treating abscesses, that kind of thing. The date for this papyrus was 1550 BC. So it also gave remedies for baldness, actually, which, if you're curious, I seem to remember that involved smearing your head with fat from a hippopotamus, a crocodile, a tomcat, a snake, and an ibex. That's not surgery, but I thought that was quite a nice little piece of information to throw in there. Also a contender, I think, for earliest surgical procedures. The procedures mentioned in the ancient Indian text, the Sushruta Samhita, and I want to mention this particularly because they're quite complex surgeries, some of them. There's caesarean sections, or what would become caesarean sections, there in there. And transplant surgery as well, which is my speciality. And that was written somewhere between 200 BC and 600 BC. But it's still a contender, I think, for the earliest recorded surgeries because everything in that text was already considered traditional at the time it was written. And no look at surgery, Emily, would be complete, I don't think, without looking at ancient Mesopotamian surgery. And actually, Mesopotamia, it seems to have been quite a strange case. Now, we were talking a minute ago, weren't we, about the relationship between doctoring and surgery. And how for most cultures and for most of history, they seem to have been separated in some important ways. Now, Mesopotamian surgery was not separated very clearly from medicine or healing or even spiritual or magic powers. And actually, if you consider, it's not usually brought up as a historical surgical text, this, but if you consider this holistic sort of treatment of surgery, lumping it in with everything else, you could say it's the oldest surgical text, and that's a good 600 years or so earlier than the Ebers Papyrus. So that's 2100 BC. So that's, I think that's the earliest known medical text at all. But I suppose there's one more thing I could say on the earliest record, and that's the last thing I want to say in response to this, really, is that if you consider bones dug up by archaeologists as recorded history, recorded surgery, then you can put the earliest recorded surgery back to 6500 BC, which is the date that skulls have been found in France with holes drilled into their heads. So that's evidence of trepanation. And that was used, some people say, to release evil spirits. But more mundanely, some of us suggest it was to relieve pressure or, you know, some kind of emergency surgery to remove bits of shattered bone.
I'm loving the coverage there, all the way from Egypt, Mesopotamia, right up to France. So from these really early procedures, I think this is a question that's quite popular. It's one from George Samuel on Facebook, and he's asked, were medieval and early modern surgeons a help or a hindrance?
Ah, well, George, that is a very good question. And this history is of course, it's a very long one, very wide-ranging one. And I think some of the questions we have coming up will definitely answer that question. And actually, I'm not sure whether it is a help or a hindrance, or in some ways it is. You know, early modern and medieval surgery was very helpful. In some ways it was less helpful. But it depends, I think, a lot on the context and on the particular kinds of surgery and what you mean by helpful and a hindrance. Because some surgical procedures were seen as helpful. Actually, I will give you an example now, and that's the example of blood transfusions between animals and humans. So one of the most famous blood transfusions in 1667 was between a lamb and a madman. And the idea was that you would transfuse blood, but not to replace lost blood, rather to transplant what was inside of the blood into the person. So a lamb is known for being calm and pure and full of, you know, the purity of God, Christ, all of that sort of symbolism. And it was thought, or certain transfusion pioneers thought, that you could transfuse the lamb's blood into a madman and make the madman automatically calmer, which you'd think would be a hindrance because it's quite dangerous to transfuse animal blood into humans. But it looked like it was helping because you can take a little bit of blood that's not compatible with your body and live. And what would happen is you'd get very, very tired. You'd have a fit, a massive fever, but it would look like you weren't mad anymore. So it looks like it helps, but it actually hinders because that ends up wearing off and you need a top up and then you end up dying eventually. But yeah, it's relative what help and hindrance mean historically. But I'm sure there will be more examples coming up.
Talking about developments and moving forward, we've got another question from Marina CRS 2018 on Instagram, and she has asked, what are some of the most influential scientific discoveries which have affected surgical practice? Do you have any examples, names, dates? That would be fantastic.
Yes, I do, you know. Well, we've already spoken about John Hunter. His greatest contribution was to give scientific credibility to surgery. And that's when that big shift took place. To make surgery, you know, more or less the way it is today. In other words, informed by science and experience. But that isn't a discovery. That's more when science began to dominate surgery. So actually, I think I want to nominate dentistry. So we tend to think dentistry has been around forever, but it hasn't. Dental care was traditionally limited to pulling teeth. But in the 18th century, it became more desirable to look after your teeth and to achieve a good smile. And there were all kinds of reasons for this. You know, people had worse teeth than ever too because of a combination of sugar consumption and malnutrition, which is not healthy. But they also wanted to look good as the beauty industry and fashion, not to mention, you know, high street and shopping, they were blossoming and becoming big things. Beauty manuals were out. Poets wrote poetry warning young girls to look after their hair and their teeth and to brush their teeth. And dentistry was a response, actually, to all these societal changes. And the first dentist was called Pierre Fauchard, French, if you couldn't tell. And what Fauchard did was to apply a scientific approach to tooth care. So this is before John Hunter, actually. So this is, you know, why he's not technically the first to do this. So back then, people all over the world, they thought that toothache was down to a little worm called a tooth worm. And when I say all over the world, I mean all over the world. So there are references to this little worm in Madagascar, in ancient Egypt, in Borneo, in Babylonia, medieval Germany and early modern France, for little lockets you know that you can find every now and then with depictions of these worms from early modern France. The Cherokee, they even have a tooth worm. And all kinds of folk remedies promise to get rid of them. So my favourite is that you have to kiss a donkey, and that will do away with the tooth worm. Another one is you had to spit salt on a fresh grave. These are all pre-application of scientific methods to surgery. So Fauchard, anyway, he saw this worm as a problem, a major problem in tooth care, and he set out to find it. But no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't. He couldn't find it, even with a microscope, even with those most advanced tools of the age. And he concluded that they didn't exist. And even if they did, they probably had nothing to do with toothache, he thought. So his entire approach was based on observation. And it led him to offer a new kind of tooth care business, which was aimed at prevention, at promoting cleaning your teeth, at not eating sugar. And when that failed, he had a menu of techniques that were very expensive then, as they are today, like filling teeth, fillings, that he invented fillings, filing your teeth, transplanting teeth even, and also washing your mouth out with urine. He wrote about that as well. We don't tend to do that now. This set of practices were performed by a very particular kind of surgeon that he called a dentiste or a dentist. And that was, you know, that was the word that was coined in 1728. It's a far cry from what was available elsewhere and before 1728, even to kings. You know, it was pretty much limited to just pulling a troublesome tooth out of the head. So that's sort of my number one most influential scientific discovery, that the tooth worm doesn't exist.
On that very strange note of tooth worms, when did surgeons first start performing more intricate surgery? This is a question we've had from Arthix on Instagram.
I think this follows on very nicely from the last question, because if I was to choose a second influential scientific discovery, I would nominate vascular anastomosis. And that basically, it sounds complex, it basically means sewing together blood vessels. And to give you a date, that would be 1901. And it's a technique that you could say is the foundation of vascular surgery. Vascular surgery is the surgery of the blood vessels and the circulatory system, that kind of thing. Because without sewing blood vessels together, you couldn't really perform effective trauma surgery. You know, when you've been stabbed or something, you couldn't really effectively treat that. You couldn't perform heart bypasses. Lots of things you couldn't do without this process of sewing blood vessels together. So it's important for very obvious reasons. But it's also important because the technique, and this is surprising, I think, the technique, at least partly, comes from 19th century French embroidery. Now, surgeons are taught when they go to medical school, and in fact, all medical students are taught that the surgeon Alexis Carrel, a French surgeon, perfected this technique in 1901. And technically, that's true. You know, he wrote the papers, he gave the lectures, he earned the Nobel Prize, although there's some question about whether he should be the sole recipient or not. But what his biographers don't tell you generally, and this is a man who is, you know, well written about, he's got lots of biographies about him in article form, but in book form as well. But they don't tell you that how he managed to come up with this technique. But there are clues. First, he didn't use the usual surgical needles. He used a special lace-making needle, which, despite being in Lyon, they were made, these needles were made by a company called Kirby in Birmingham. Second, he didn't use the cat gut that other surgeons used. Instead, he used fine linen or cotton thread that he bought from a local haberdashery. And third, he had lessons from a very famous embroiderer called Marianne Leroudier. Now, she was impressive, to say the least. She embroidered the gold thread on the Paris Opera House curtains. She won medals in the Chicago Exposition, in Amsterdam as well. Her work is part of the Vatican's collection, the museum. Most of it's held in the Museum of Textiles in Lyon still. So Carrel's biographers usually mention that he learned to sew from a seamstress and he was inspired by her, and that he was taught by her because he was the best and he couldn't learn from anybody but the best. But you know, the history of surgery, it's full of self-styled great men. The answers to a lot of the questions that your listeners are asking, actually, they invite the kinds of answers that are about these surgical heroes. And they are stories worth telling, of course. But I wanted to nominate anastomosis as something to talk about here, because it's an influential scientific discovery. And even though I think that actually probably stretches the definition of a scientific discovery, it shows how something that has been imbued with a kind of masculinity, like surgery, actually evolved at least partly from French embroidery, and that at the heart of today's surgery, most important and vital and intricate surgery, are actually skills that have been developed by generations of women craftspeople.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Semmelweis's colleagues didn't believe him. And I understand that towards the end of his life, he'd walk around the city and he'd grab hold of pregnant women, sort of saying, make sure that the person delivering your baby washes their hands. And he was actually admitted to a Viennese mental hospital.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
While we're here, I'd like to take a bit of a tangent. We've got a few questions about this that I'd really like to talk about. So they're all ones about the role of women in surgery. Tamara Suter on Instagram has asked, what has the role of women been historically with surgical practice?
Yeah, women were embedded in certain medical systems in ways that were very important, actually central to many treatments, but weren't named. Elizabeth Blackwell, she was the first woman doctor to graduate in America. She graduated in 1849, the top of her class in Geneva Medical School, and she believed that nature made women better healers than men. And she went on later to found the New York Infirmary for indigent women, and she organized nurses as well in the American Civil War. So in Britain, there was also Elizabeth Garrett, and she exploited various loopholes to get her diploma from the Society of Apothecaries. But women have underrepresented, it won't come as a surprise for you to hear. I've got some data from the US, you know, until 1970, women made up no more than 6% of any medical school class in the US and Canada. By 2001, that number was 24%, and currently it's about equal, which is nice to hear. But for much of the history of surgery and of medicine in general, women have actually, they've had key roles to play outside of the narrative of the self-styled, usually self-styled, great men. And in a lot of cases, these were also peasant women, so very poor women who had no real recourse to education. Well, to legitimate university education. Of course, they were very well educated, very skilled. I believe there's a question coming up where we'll talk a little bit about that. That class of woman healer and their importance outside of the traditional narratives that we tell about the history of surgery.
So let's explore that question now then. Which surgical procedure do you think was the most impressive or advanced for the time that it was pioneered in?
I like this question, but I'm going to answer it in a kind of sideways way, I think. This question seems to be getting at the idea that surgery and science go hand in hand. And that hasn't always been the case. So let me give you an example from about 500 years ago. 500 years ago, what was that? It was a great age of exploration and discovery. And that's the period when fragments of the new world started to make their way to European shores, you know, pulled out of the holes of these great Indiamen and merchantmen of that age. So it was a time of scientific discovery, of exploration. So Andreas Vesalius, who was a very famous anatomist at the time, he published his great work, his anatomy book, The Fabrica, which basically, it sounds like a minor thing to us today, possibly, but it recorded what he actually saw when he was dissecting bodies, whereas, you know, for hundreds of years, people would parrot the ancients. We talked about that briefly earlier as well. And so that started to undermine faith in traditional medical systems at the time. And that was published at the same year that Copernicus placed the sun at the center of the solar system. So what I'm trying to say is that 500 years ago, the scientific world was vibrant. But there was also a kind of surgery that was part of traditional culture that had nothing to do with the scientific revolution. So empirics, they were a kind of practitioner that disregarded theory and disregarded book learning, and they trusted only their senses and what their experience could tell them, basically. And this seems like quite a normal approach to us now, in a way, you know, just trust what you can see and sense, what empirically you can judge to be the case. But back in the Renaissance, it was seen by the medical authorities as quite backwards, actually. So one of my favourite characters in the history of surgery, he was an empiric called Leonardo Fioravanti. And he'd travel all over Italy and he'd look for cures that worked. And a lot of these people, so this is relating to the last question, actually, a lot of these people were wise women who obviously had names and identities, but they were never recorded. But Fioravanti saw value in what they were doing. And he saw that their remedies in many cases worked when, you know, the remedies touted by university-educated doctors were a load of rubbish. So, old wise women, soldiers as well, basically peasants who lived closest to the land and knew about nature's healing potential. And that didn't always lead to the most enlightened surgery. So there's a story where Fioravanti actually is performing surgery on a patient's spleen. And I think he must have picked up somewhere that urine had a some kind of cleansing property. And he requested his assistants and the spectators, people watching the operation, to unbutton their trousers and to relieve themselves into the patient's open abdomen. Skin grafting, moving swiftly on, skin grafting, that was one of those operations he observed, and he noticed that it was actually more, this is one of my favourite things about Fioravanti, actually. He noticed that skin grafting was actually more or less the same operations that farmers, again, looking at the land, looking at culture, at tradition, not at university science, but noticed that farmers performed the same operation just on plants. And it's a direct transposition. A skin graft is a direct transposition from plants to people. And it was actually so close, the procedure, that he called transplant surgery the agriculture of the body. And in another book that he wrote a few years later, this is sort of 1550s now, 1560s, he called it the farming of men. And I'd say that this was pretty advanced surgery, especially for the time. But actually, it had nothing to do with what we might call modern science. It was a more traditional approach, where science at the time was arguably less advanced.
So while we're talking about transplants, this is obviously your research exactly. This is one of our top searches as well. You've spoken a little bit about the origins of transplant surgery, but can you delve into a little bit more detail? How different is transplant surgery today from its earlier roots?
It could hardly be more different, I've got to say. Well, I mentioned the Sushruta Samhita, the ancient Indian surgical text earlier. That included a transplant. It was a skin graft. And that involved moving skin within the same body from the forehead to the nose, because you could lose your nose in many different ways back then, whether it be a sabre wound or a ruler could punish you. In Egypt, there was a town inhabited with people who had no noses, an entire town. So basically, you just sort of move the skin from the forehead to where the nose would have been and shape it into a nose. And, that's also the first plastic surgery. And they seem actually to have been quite successful because, of course, you're not going to reject skin from your own body. I mean, there might have been an infection risk, but when you're not also dealing with autopsies and things, the infection risk is not non-existent, but minimal. So then, after skin grafts, there are blood transfusions between animals and humans. We talked about that as well, and that would be a kind of transplant, an animal's soul or a personality or some kind of quality it had. Some pioneers thought you could transplant the youth of a young animal. We've already spoken about the calmness of a lamb. One surgeon even thought there was something in cat's blood that could cure epilepsy. Which actually, just a little factoid here, in the 17th century, epilepsy was called falling sickness. And I wonder whether it's because cats fall on their feet. I wonder. I don't know. But after transfusions or personality or soul transplants, whichever way you want to look at it, teeth, they were transplanted in the 18th century. So we've already talked about dentistry as well. Transplanting teeth, that was part of a dentist's offer to his customers. And that's the first time body parts were put up for sale as transplants. And I suppose behind that question, actually. It's actually more to do with organ transplants. So I'll have to mention Alexei Carrel as well and his vascular anastomosis, because you can't transplant an organ without sewing it in. And he actually attempted some of the earliest organ transplants as well, but every one of them failed because of some unknown biological force. So that was rejection. Of course, we know that now, but he didn't know that. Actually, he had some kind of inkling because of someone else who worked in a lab next to him, but that's a sort of side story. I'd also have to mention, actually, a Russian scientist who never gets, well, rarely gets mentions, Vladimir Demikov. He performed the first heart transplant in dogs, and that's 1946. The first lung transplant a year later, and a year after that, he did a liver transplant. So all on dogs. In the 50s, he created 24 two-headed dogs by transplanting the front portion of a puppy onto the dogs. And all these poor animals obviously died, you know, because foreign bodies were always rejected. But the first successful human-to-human transplant, that involved two American twins. This is 1954, and the story basically goes that Richard Herrick, he came down with kidney disease when he was 22. He was a soldier in the Korean War, and he ended up in hospital, first in Chicago, then in Boston, where a surgeon called Joseph Murray had this idea that his twin might be a good donor. It's a very unusual circumstance, you know, having a twin and having kidney disease. But organ transplants, all the experiments until then had all failed, really, some more spectacularly than others. But it had recently been discovered that grafts between identical twins weren't rejected. So the team approached Richard's brother, Ronald, and after some soul searching, he decided to donate his kidney. You know, his brother would die definitely otherwise. So it was his only sort of chance. But it was quite a gesture on his part, because it wasn't clear back then, you know, what it would be like living with only one kidney. Maybe it would shorten his life, actually. But as it turned out, the operation was a complete success. Richard ended up marrying one of his nurses and having children. But he died within 8 years because his kidney disease returned. And that finished off his brother's kidney. But Ronald actually went on to live until he was 79. I suppose one more thing to say on transplants, because I've spoken quite a bit on that, as you might expect. Transplants, they only really became routinely successful since effective immunosuppression. So that's drugs to suppress the immune system. And that's quite important, because it shows how integrated surgery has become with other professions. And actually, transplants are, they're fairly simple procedures, really. I mean, I couldn't perform one. But as surgery goes, it's really, it comes down to coupling up a few ducts and vessels. The drugs management, and actually the rest of the infrastructure around the surgery and around looking after the patient, that's where the complexity and the difficulty is. And that's where it becomes quite difficult, actually, to distinguish between surgery and other kinds of medicine and other kinds of technology.
Daniel Wigmore on Twitter has asked, how have surgical tools developed in line with other technologies?
We just sort of hit on, I suppose, where I'd like to go answering this question in my last answer, which is about transplant surgery, because I'm not really sure, actually, where the distinction between surgical tools and other technologies starts and ends. But I suppose what I actually want to talk about in response to this is laparoscopy. That's keyhole surgery, basically. And I knew one of the pioneers of keyhole surgery, and his name was John Wickham, and very few people have heard of him. A very quiet man. And he died just a few years ago. But he more or less introduced laparoscopy into general surgery, where surgeons had, I mean, some surgeons had, they'd used various scopes and tools to perform very specific techniques. I know gynecology had a kind of laparoscopy earlier in the 20th century. But John in the 1970s, he had a very collaborative style of leadership, and he actively involved radiography. You know, so you can scan live what's happening inside of the body and use imaging technology whilst you've got your scope inside of the patient and while you're looking through some lenses. But also he involved instrument manufacturers so that he could develop technology that was appropriate and specialized for that very particular kind of, you know, keyhole surgery, putting a tiny instrument through a tiny nick in the body and cutting away and pulling things out, all kinds of things like that. So laparoscopy, keyhole surgery developed in concert with other technologies. Now, I was interested, something about John that I quite liked, and I think this is he displayed in this way an important quality for surgery becoming more collaborative. I asked him at the end of his life, how would you like to be remembered, John? And he said, oh, I don't know, maybe that I've saved one or two people a little bit of trouble. And I just thought, oh, John. But it was a genuine response. He was that kind of person. But also, that's one of the reasons you won't have heard of John. He didn't grandstand. He wasn't one of those Alexis Carrel types of surgeons who insisted that he be the center of attention, his work be central to, you know, the way surgery goes forward. He foregrounded his colleagues. He foregrounded the system. And he recognized that surgery can't stand alone as a profession, really. It has to be seen in context with other technologies, other professions. So I think that's what I'd like to say about surgery being developed in line with other technologies.
So I think one of the really important things to talk about when we're talking about the history of surgery is this question by Jamie Gartside 1 on Instagram, which was, how dangerous and risky was surgery in the past?
Extremely dangerous and risky in the past. To sort of give you a very broad answer, the main risk, or the most important risk to talk about, I think, is the risk of infection. So that's bacteria and sepsis. And I believe that we have a question exactly about that, don't we?
Well, we do indeed. We've actually got one from Roberta Alessandra on Facebook, who has asked, even after the discovery of the relationship between bacteria and disease, why were some surgeons hesitant about washing their hands?
Well, infection, big problem in surgery. So let's say early 19th century, a patient would be lying on a wooden table. There would be sawdust underneath to sort of soak up the spilt blood. The surgeon would be wearing a gown that was caked in various stains and encrusted maybe with other patients' blood and pus and things like that. And a surgeon might wash their hands, but they'd wait till after the operation. They wouldn't necessarily wash before. So as a consequence, sepsis, gangrene, rife, basically. And the problem really came into focus in Vienna in the 1840s on two maternity wards, basically. One of them had a mortality rate of 29%, 29% death rate in one maternity ward. The other one had a death rate of 3%. The difference was that the births in the first ward were being handled by medical students. And in the second wards, one with a lower death rate, were being handled by midwifery students. And they changed places as an experiment, and the deaths followed the medical students. Now, of course, those students, what were they doing before then? They were being exposed to all kinds of bacteria because they'd come straight from autopsies and they'd be bringing their instruments with them and they wouldn't necessarily be washing their hands before. So The assistant physician, Ignaz Semmelweis, he ordered hand washing to be implemented in chlorinated water before any deliveries were attempted, and that actually solved the problem quite clearly. The thing is, Semmelweis's colleagues didn't believe him. And I understand that towards the end of his life, he'd walk around the city and he'd grab hold of pregnant women, sort of saying, make sure that the person delivering your baby washes their hands. And he was actually admitted to a Viennese mental hospital, where, in a cruel twist, he died of the same infections that he identified. And that was in 1865. We, of course, then have Joseph Lister. Now, I've got to give a shout out to Lindsay Fitzharris here, who has written an extraordinary book on Joseph Lister called The Butchering Art. Anyway, Lister, he concluded that bacteria was harmed by carbolic acid. It had antiseptic properties. And he became convinced that it could and should be used to clean wounds and keep out infection. So there's one story from 1865 of a boy called James Freenlees, and he'd been run over by a cart. And Lister used lint soaked in carbolic acid and in linseed oil. He used that to dress the wound, and it stayed infection-free. A few months later, he applied the same treatment, and the wounds healed again without infection. So he developed a kind of a... I think Roy Porter, the historian of medicine, used to describe it as a kind of ritual for antisepsis. So first, clotted blood, that would be removed. The wound would then be bathed in carbolic. Carbolic-soaked lint would then be applied to the wound and covered with tin foil packed with wool as well. And then when a new dressing was needed, the wound was cleaned again with carbolic. So when Lister wrote about this ritual and his experiences tackling sepsis for the Lancet in 1867, he was able to report that none of the patients he worked on died of sepsis. So Semmelweis and Lister, they are two very important names in how surgeons really became convinced that, as Roberta put it, washing hands was a very good idea.
I think you've also in that answered another question we've had from Susan Politz on Twitter. And I think another question I've got to ask you is one we've had a few people ask us about: TW on Twitter, Secret Run on Instagram, and Jamie Gartside One on Instagram, all about anaesthetic. When did anaesthetics come about? And maybe could you give us some examples of some early types of anaesthetic?
So Humphrey Davy, I'll mention him first, because he wrote about laughing gas. It was basically a sort of something for his parties to begin with, but he did write about its potential as an anaesthetic as early as 1799. But the first really effective anaesthetic was ether, and that was used first in 1842 in a case that isn't usually brought up because it's not well documented, but it was used by a surgeon called Crawford Williamson Long. And he removed a tumour from the neck of a patient using ether, knocking him out with ether. But he wasn't very good at publishing his results, so he's not really credited. Most people cite the first official use of ether as being, not too long after that, 1846, by a dentist in Boston. And you applied ether by soaking a towel in it and holding it to the patient's face until they lost consciousness. Chloroform, also used around that time, so that's first recorded use of that, 1847. But if you administer that kind of anaesthetic incorrectly, you could cause all kinds of problems, even death, actually. I once knew, again, like John Wickham, I once knew a very elderly anaesthesiologist, and he was called Stanley Feldman. And he told me that I can't believe he was this old, but he told me that when he first learned to do anesthesiology, he'd learned to apply ether. And so this can't have been, I mean, it was 20th century, so I don't know where he learned. But he told me that for various masks and things, the Schimmelbusch mask he used to talk about. And if you surprised the patient and they breathed in too deeply, they could, you know, have an overdose of it. But he told me actually that early in his career, his patients didn't like being anaesthetized. And one or two of them actually tried to get up and punch him in the face.
Clearly better received by some, I think.
You could say that.
To wrap us up, can you give us your favourite historical fact about the history of surgery?
One of my favourite things about surgery is that it sort of relates to a lot of things we've said already, but it's that it tends to take on board other specialisms, other professions, all the way back to the earliest surgery, which, surgeons learnt from farmers how to perform certain techniques. But we're sort of seeing a kind of a return to this agricultural, horticultural way of looking at the body, which I find quite exciting. So when we think about what we can do with stem cells now, so it's technically possible to print body parts. There are a few companies in America and Canada who will print things like tracheas and, you know, windpipes, and they will infect them with asthma and use it to sort of as a way to sort of test cures and things like that. But printing, 3D printing, hasn't yet reached the level of resolution required to form those, you know, tiny vessels, the capillaries. So what is happening in the meantime is, for instance, with heart tissue and with skin, actually, is that some scientists at Harvard and at Worcester Polytechnic Institute have used a particular detergent to decellularize spinach leaves. So you take away all the spinach matter and you're left with a frame that's a collagen frame, basically. So it's neutral. And you can populate that with human heart cells, your own heart cells, skin cells, and that can be implanted directly into the body to plug a hole in the heart with a spinach leaf. So it's sort of, there's a Popeye joke somewhere in there, isn't there, really? And it's not at the stage of clinical application, of course, but I think it's what's exciting about that is, well, two things, really. One, that return to, you know, the plant and people relationship, that's kind of symbolic resonance, I suppose you could say. And the other exciting thing for me, I think, about that is that, you know, we think that having a heart transplant from a pig is advanced, which it is. And it was very impressive what happened earlier this year. But I think it's even more exciting to think about how a bit of a human could come from a plant. And it sort of raises questions about what it means to be human. When bits of an animal or bits of a plant could literally become part of your body. What does it mean to have an identity when bits of you, bits of future you are no longer in existence or belong in other people's bodies? That's the most fascinating thing about transplant surgery. And for medicine in general, when we break down the barriers between humans, animals, and plants, what does it mean to be alive? So that the most exciting thing is, in conclusion, to sort of offer you a final point there, the history of surgery is very exciting for me because it enables us to ask very deep philosophical questions that we all kind of ask ourselves at one point or another.
That was Paul Craddock, who's a cultural historian and the author of the book Spare Parts, A Surprising History of Transplants. I spoke to Paul about that book back in 2021. So if you'd like to hear that interview, just search for Transplant Surgery on historyextra.com or your podcast feeds to bring that up. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.